This recording is brought to you by the Same Same But Different Writers Festival and PrideNZ.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Now and Then session of Same Same But Different. Tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. Over the next hour or so, you'll be hearing the work of nine writers. We're presenting the Wallace Arts Prize for Best Short Story, and we'll hear the winner read their work. And finally, Ron Brownson will give an acknowledgement of David Lyndon Brown, one of our community's literary lights who passed away in December. I'd like to start off proceedings by inviting Nod Ghosh and Jade Dupreez to join me on stage, please. Round of applause. All right, now just a brief interlude. The Pride Writing Competition was created 2 years ago by Alternative Bindings. Alternative Bindings is Andrew Rumbles, Gina Cole, who's here. Welcome, Gina. Michael Jacon, who's also here. Welcome, Michael, and myself. We are four individuals who love words and were determined to make literary events an important part of Pride. The writing competition provides a safe and supportive environment for both emerging and established writers to share their stories. And this year, we've been honoured by the support of the Wallace Arts Trust, who have provided the generous prize, as well as lending their name and prestige to the award. So thank you very, very much. Other than the maximum length of 750 words and a theme, a Kiwi romance, there were no restrictions on entries, and the stories we received expressed the triumph and joy of alternate sexuality or the pain and difficulty of being different. There were funny stories, sad stories, sweet stories, bitter stories, outrageous situations, and introspective reflections. The quality of the submissions was astounding, and as always, the judges had great difficulty choosing a winner. I'm honoured to welcome to the stage Sir James Wallace, who will be presenting the awards. Ladies and gentlemen, Sir James Wallace. The runner-up in the Wallace Arts Trust Prize for Short Fiction is Nod Ghosh. With her... Nod's story, Seven Lesbians in a Bar of Soap, it was the winner. Nod is a medical laboratory assistant in Christchurch and has had stories accepted in various New Zealand and international publications. Nod's maxim? Writers are like humans, but they watch less television. Thank you, Nod. The winner of this year's Wallace Arts Trust Prize for the Best Short Story is Jade Dupreez. Jade's story was titled Lily of the Valley. Jade is a gifted and regularly exhibited visual artist, in fact. She's currently studying for a law degree with a view to a career in, wait for it, human rights. So, thank you very much. A round of applause, please, for both of our winners. All right, I would now like to invite Jade to read her winning story.
Thank you very much, everyone here, and obviously to the Wallace Trust and everyone who's organised. I shall be succinct. These are my 750 words. Koro was 11 when he lost his words. Not lost. That sounds forgetful. His words were taken. V said, that happened to a generation. I said, like I care about a generation? I said, what kind of a name is V anyway? Guess I got a bit happy on the bourbon. Didn't usually talk to randoms. V curled her mouth like she'd been waiting to be asked. A dirty one, she said. She looked over the top of her paper cup, like she reckoned she was actually in a movie or something. Like she had a crystal glass that caught the light of the hotel chandelier and that she'd just admitted to being a double agent. Like she wasn't actually at Stupid Kingy's stupid graduation, half in the dark, on a lawn turfed up by cars, accompanied by a sound system from the 90s, playing songs from the 80s. Great, I said. as flat as I could. "You can explain it to the guy over there." I nodded to a flat beak leaning on a Corolla. "Been checking you out long enough." "Him?" She looked over serenely. "Nah, he asked me to ask you." "Eh?" I stared so he noticed. He was nervous, laughed with his shoulders. "Why?" V grinned. "Probably because he doesn't know you're a homo." "I'm not," I sighed. This is probably the softball thing again. "Pity," V said. Then, even though I never asked, "My name is Lily." Was she joking? There was pretty much nothing Lily-like about her. Not silent, not Lily-livered, definitely not white. It was updated to Lily of the Valley. Get it? Ah, yeah, funny. I didn't get it. But that was none of her business. V is faster to say, easier to yell. She raised her eyebrows, closed her eyes. Could have been in a movie, I forget which one. Turned out she was studying languages, a linguist. She had a research project. She wanted to speak to my koro. Yeah, fine, not my business. She came over 4 days after. She had a laptop and flash glasses. Away from that crowd, she spoke differently, softly. She pulled out and threaded her sentences. Throw her any line and she'd weave it into a long-winded odyssey of history and policy. It turned out her name was a kind of homo joke. My koro liked her. She came over again, then again. Sometimes it was just me at home. Then it seems like we weren't starting new meetings, just that there were some interruptions in one long one. I called her Lily. I wanted to keep a secret part of her. She wasn't a lily like one of those wild monster ones that crowd out the compost. She was more like one of those bursting ones from the shops. All kinds of bright colours. Bright smelling, dropping pollen all over the rug. Lingering. She'd come back from uni and release her latest phrases. All the sad German ones. All the stubborn French ones. She said, "I love you" in 11 languages. 3 of them had no words. She retold the story of my koro. She shuffled through photographs and found a likeness in me. "The way of his lip," Lily said. "He's resisting a fight. You do that." "I'm not a chicken," I said. "Come away with me," she said. She'd won a scholarship. She was that smart. She was going south. Then everything went south. Koro was given a few months max. I didn't tell Lily, just cancelled our meetings. Koro wasn't up to much, I'd say. Really tired today. Wasn't her business anymore. I didn't want too many people poking around anyway. Full on sorting out the maids, food, dressing. She didn't need to see that. It was fast. First he stopped speaking, then seeing. Then he was just the pair of lungs in my grandfather's body in the hospice. I lost my words. I hated all those ones from kind people, for the best, put to rest, so impressed, blessed, lest. Less, I thought, that is all that comes. No more I love yous. Lily came up, sprung from nowhere. Someone must have told her, wasn't their business, but I let it go. I didn't say much to her. Watched the spot on the ground where her roots would have been if she'd been true to her name. When we were alone, she read me her research, put him in the story. I didn't mind that. How does it finish? It doesn't, she said. Thank you.
A well-deserved win. Thank you very, very much, Jade. We wish you well in your studies, and we hope to read lots more of your work. Hint, hint, hint. All right. In this now and then session, we're exploring how things have changed and how things have stayed the same. And we'll be doing this through the voices of 9 individual writers, each of whom will share with us a piece of their work. 4 of these will be established writers, noted for their evocation of our challenging past, and 5 will be new voices, emerging, largely young writers who are developing their voice in a world that is very different to the world I grew up in. So, what has changed for today's LGBTQI writers? Has anything changed? Each of our established writers has had to struggle against many currents, social, political, and in some cases personal, just to have their voices heard. Yet, despite sweeping changes for our community, it would seem that struggle remains an inevitable part of LGBTQI experience. The forces and forms may have changed, the gatekeepers may wear new masks, and the media we use has most certainly morphed into shapes we couldn't have predicted, or maybe science fiction writers could have. But struggle, it seems, remains. Perhaps it's an inevitable part, inevitable fact of life for those of us who often find ourselves on the margins. At the end of this session, each of you will be able to form your own opinion about what has changed, about what hasn't, an understanding informed by the voices of now and the voices of then. I'd like to welcome our first speaker to the podium, Ruby Porter. Ruby completed a BA BFA with first class honours and is doing a Master of Creative Writing this year at Auckland University, in which she plans to finish a novel. She has recorded several of her poems for the next 6-pack sounds, available soon on the New Zealand Electronic Poetry Centre website. Thank you.
Hi, I'm feeling a little bit sick, so if I dart off after this, I'm not trying to be rude. This poem is called Imogen. Her tutor was saying, "It's unimaginable. Like, no true or false, no like or dislike, no love. They could only have touched and untouched. She's untouched, touched in the back seat by a boy she doesn't like much. She thinks when she googled vampire squids, she must have seen the babies because they looked more like axolotls. Flusa says they are orgasmic. She hasn't orgasmed in months. She thinks she could be one, wouldn't mind doing it by herself. Hermaphrodite, meaning self-sufficient. They're only scared of each other. She gets that. Parked up outside Kelly Towton's, where she's seen the photos, they went. Imagine eerie conversation like, leave her for me. Okay, the last time she touched a girl, she was high and in a pool. Now she's below all of that. Imagines heavy, she can swim beneath everyone she's ever known. That's what an island means, right? Floating, wet all over, like a fetus. I don't know whether it's too far from us or too close. He means the other parked car. She means the womb, a memory we've all forgotten. She hasn't forgotten that night, except that'd be warm and this'd be cold. Sometimes at night it's so cold she can't feel anything. Thinking, does it struggle to float like walking underwater, hundreds of meters down? Apparently, when they come to the surface, they explode. And then this next one's called State Highway 1B. Out the window, winter's hardness is just beginning to show. The branches of the poplars seem to curl inwards for warmth. I put on the heater, but you say you can't stand it. You are always too hot, and I am always too cold. What did you mean by that? You meant, of course, the way I curl inwards. Pull over, stop the car. By now you have counted 3 dead sheep. I wish you wouldn't point it out, but I don't say anything. The snow is crunchy dirty, only white from a distance. I sit on the bonnet for warmth, while you crouch behind a poplar. There are fences everywhere, but no houses. When you introduced me, you called me Claire's friend. What did you mean by that? You meant, of course, there's no use in counting. The inside of the car is blurring now too. We keep searching, but we only find static. I try to turn on the heater again, but you open the window. You say, we need to stop breathing the same air over and over again. Pull over, stop the car. What did you mean by that? You meant we're moving too fast, but it all looks the same to me. The numbers that go down are just for show. When we left that night, you only held my hand when we got to the car. I was going to ask where you went, but you say, I am too interested in the degrees between us, the space to cool off, and I should try to be more outgoing, over the limit. I want to put my hand on your knee, but I don't know how to spread myself wide enough. And you say, don't bother. This bend in the road is the conversation. Your words are tarmac. What did you mean by that? You meant, of course, the sign a few K's back. We must have missed it already.
Thank you, Ruby. Amazing. What a way to start. That's going to be hard to follow. Wow, the use of pace and rhythm in that, just astounding. Just amazing. My heart's still slowing. Next up, I would like to call to the podium Awara McLeod. Many people in this room, including myself, were taught by Awara in the English department at the University of Auckland, where she worked for 37 years, am I allowed to say that? 37 years. She undertook the MA in Creative Writing at Victoria University in 2011. She is published as a critic, she's edited anthologies, but she's probably best known for a book, Who Was That Woman Anyway? Awara.
Well, this is a piece I wrote in 2016, this year, for lesbians in 2016. And I've called it Casting Off. The fan turns slowly, making a tired crack with each circuit. Three women are sitting amidst cartons piled high with books. Books donated to the centre by women retiring, women downsizing, women down decluttering. Okay, what about this one? It's Angie, her long tattooed legs sprawled out on the floor amongst the books, where she's just upended a carton. Now this one's got an awesome cover. Hot pink, with two naked embracing women, and the title's Lesbian Sex. Oh God, not another one. Beth rummages into the carton between her knees and pulls out a lurid pink Lesbian Sex. By Joanne Lulan, and I bet you've got this one too. Lesbian Passion by Joanne Lulan. Purple cover with embracing naked women. We all bought Joanne Lulan until the rumour that she'd got married to a man was confirmed in the 90s. Hey, but this one's got an inscription. And Beth reads out, to my beloved Gwen, on the third year of our rapturous lifelong journey, your lover Pam. Oh no, Steffi murmurs from her beanbag. I know them. Or rather, I knew them. Pam's had two, or is it three, beloveds since then? Yes, says Beth. Most of them do ink out their names or rip out the cover page. But you know, it's awful. I've got all these books on my shelves, yellowing pages, covered in dust. And she reads out some of the names, flinging them onto the throw-out carton. Tangled Sheets, Stories and Poems of Lesbian Lust. The Lesbian Reader. Lavender Culture, Lesbian Images, Lesbian Nation, 1980s, 1990s. We were all so eager, so desperate for information about being lesbian, that we'd read anything with the word lesbian on the cover. How we wanted them. We needed them to help us define ourselves. Look here, Lesbian Ethics. She holds up a very thick book with a serious non-pink cover. So far we've got 5 copies of this, and I've got one at home. Haven't read it for over 30 years. I'm 75, and these are the books that gave me words for myself. When I had my first affair in 1960, would you believe it? I don't think I'd even heard the word lesbian. Do you realise, Steph says, you said, oh God, not another one. We'd never have said that in the 80s. Don't you remember what Mary Daly said? God represents the necropolis of the patriarchy. Wow, says Angie, that's a lot of laughs. The necropolis of the patriarchy. And listen to this. She's been thumbing through Lesbian Sex. Did you really do this? Here, page 259, Exercises for Orgasmic Responses. this is hilarious. It's in the homework section. And she, and she reads out, orgasmic response with yourself, exercises 1-7. Step 1, write a letter to your sexual response. Tell it how dissatisfied you are. Really let your body know how it has let you down. Now, do you want to have orgasms? Do you feel you're missing something if you haven't had orgasms? Do you have resentment that your partner has them so easily? Do you think you're not vulnerable and open because you don't have orgasms? And there's so much more. Did you guys really write letters to your orgasms? No, sorry, to your sexual responses. All right, Beth says. No, I didn't. I never got that far in the book anyway. And I never had problems with orgasms. My first lesbian affair was my first orgasm. I just needed to know what to call it. Hey, here's one that looks well used, says Steph. In Our Own Hands, a book of self-help therapy. Lots of markings and turned down pages. I remember this book. I was in a self-help group that used it. And she grins at Beth. Angie stretches out, grabs the book and reads from the introduction. In order to understand the sexism, competitiveness, possessiveness and authoritarianism fostered by the family within capitalism. Oh, wow, that's so cool. I love the language. It was a great group, said Beth. That's how Steph and I got together. 1984. It was a lesbian version of the consciousness-raising groups that were spreading everywhere with feminism. My God, was it really 30 years ago? Well, says Angie, what should we keep? One sex, one passion, one ethics? Nope, interrupts Beth. Out with all of them. No one would read them now except perhaps to laugh at them, like you. Oh, okay. But here's one that doesn't have lesbian in the title. Macho Sluts. Now, it's got a... I should have brought it. Now, it's got a great cover. Look, high-heeled black boot on someone's black leather back who seems to have a face into someone's black leather crutch. And look, the author's wearing black leather and it's got black shades. I've got that one as well, Beth says. It's still on my bookshelf. That was a scary book back in, and was it, late 80s? It was about sadomasochism in the days when we were supposed to be writing letters to our vanilla orgasms. We all bought it, to find out what it was about. She turns back to her desk. I've just catalogued a bunch of new books the centre's bought. Sam Orchard's Family Portraits, that cute graphic novel about being a trans boy. Trans love, trans bodies, trans selves. That's the latest thing, not lesbianism. Steph pulls out a limp, battered book from her carton. Here's The Female Eunuch. That book was so important. We did all read that. Actually, I still quite like Germaine Greer. I didn't think her comments about trans women were so bad. You know, when she said post-operative trans women were not women. Good God, says Beth. Sorry, I forgot. Great goddess. Beware, Steph, or Angie will be throwing glitter at you and calling you a TERF. Come again? What's a TERF? T-E-R-F. It's a trans-exclusionary radical feminist. Means you're trapped in 1980s essentialist feminism. Really bad. Transphobic. Oh, says Steph. What are they saying now about Greer? An old lady with outdated views. Perhaps that's me. Not you two, says Angie. Look how busy you all are throwing your pasts away.
Who was that woman anyway? Thank you, Aura. That was just stunning. A lovely evocation of now and then. Nothing more needs to be said. Next up, I would like to invite Samira Davis to the podium. Samira is another one of our new voices. Samira is a poet whose work has been published in Redraft, Ica, and Landfall. She is studying creative writing at MIT and was awarded One to Watch at the 2015 New Zealand Poetry Slam Finals. She's currently working on a short story collection that explores sexuality and human connection.
That was brilliant. This first poem I'm going to read is called Sestina, and it's a response to a poem written about 50 years ago by Mary Stanley. If you don't know the format of a sestina, it's six stanzas with the end of each line repeating six words in a very specific order. So that's hence the repetition. Right now it hurts to look back, giving you that heart-shaped cookie to eat. You kept it in the freezer in hope of love, reminding me I am queer. Deep in my blood you sprouted and grew. What made you change my mind? I said I would write. You didn't mind. Fingers left keys to cradle your back. In the winter, our romance grew under thick blankets where we'd eat each other, proud and queer, disturbing the nights with our love. You read my past as lack of love. Nothing I said could ease your mind. The accusations created a queer numbness burrowing through my back, ready to pounce and eat. Buried deep, this numbness grew. A year of doubt, and we grew apart. You questioning my love, seeing betrayal in the foods I'd eat, as if my body shape would lead me back to men, or that my mind only saw you as my badge of being queer. You saw me as more straight than queer. When the desire to write my past grew strong, you fought hard to hold me back. You showed contempt and shunned my love, cutting away the passion of my mind. You took more than you could eat. Those bitter words, those heavy chains, began to eat the heart of me till the queer, numb surfaced and escaped my mind. My lost self returned, my strength grew into words you feared and forced. I don't love you. I am leaving and won't come back. In fear you forced my hand from love. Your words into reality grew. The cookie broke. I made up my mind. And the second poem I'll read today is interestingly titled Sex Poems with No Bra On. However, I am wearing one. You've carved a pentagram in the wood of your guitar. The lighter you hold against the fret is orange, sliding up and down. My legs are tucked under the neck so I can watch your fingers from behind. You make the tui silent. You make me write songs in my head that I'm too scared to sing because I know my music isn't as strong as yours, but it was me who described how we felt that night. So you play, and I breathe in the sun. And tomorrow, I will be jealous of myself for having spent the day with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Samira. That was amazing. I can feel a bit of a synergy emerging. Seems to be a conversation spontaneously forming here between past and the present. Maybe it'll lead us to the future. Next up, I would like to welcome Paula Bock. I simply can't compress Paula's achievements into a 20-second introduction. So, skimming the surface of a very deep pond, she has been Otago University's Burns Fellow. She co-founded Longacre Press, won the AIM Best First Book Award for Outworked Mel, won the New Zealand Post Children's Book Award for Dear Truth or Promise, and has been shortlisted for the US Lambda Literary Awards. She's a television writer who worked on The Strip, Brotown, and Insider's Guide to Happiness. She inaugurated Lippy Pictures, whose productions Tangawai and Tulpery of an Innocent and Field Punishment No. 1 have won multiple awards in Australia and New Zealand. And actually, I rode a horse on Field Punishment No. 1. Indeed. She's an incredibly diverse writer and makes the rest of us feel completely lazy.
Thank you very much, Brendan. You can hear me here, can't you? Yes, it's the nodding at the back I'm looking for. I'll have to be quick. I'm going to read from Dear Truth or Promise because I don't get very many opportunities to these days, and it was quite nice to pull it out and reread it. Looking forward to this, and because there's something about then and now, because I wrote this in 1997, it was the first YA lesbian novel in New Zealand. There weren't very many in the world, and so it was quite controversial there. I'd like to think such a thing wouldn't be controversial now. But I did write it deliberately, knowing it would be controversial, and because there just weren't any books for young queer women coming out. And there was one book for by a New Zealand writer, William Taylor, The Blue Lawn, which explored young gay love. And also, obviously, as a writer, I wanted to write it because one always wants to kind of reimagine the most complex and powerful experience of your life. And at that time, in my 20s, it was coming out. This is a little excerpt. The two protagonists are Louie and Willa. They're both 16. They're at school. They're kind of going out on a date, I guess, an unusual date. And they have arrived at a patch of farmland in the middle of nowhere. And Louie doesn't know what's in store. "There," said Willa. "There she is." Louis followed her gaze. They stood about a paddock's length away from the end of the runway, staring straight down two lines of neon blue spots. At the far end were the flashing red and white lights of an aircraft coasting into position. Louis looked at Willa, her heart already beginning to pump. "You're mad. You're absolutely bloody crazy. This is your idea of fun?" Willa was transfixed by the sight of the plane. They could hear its engines in the distance, the combination of roar and whine that always thrilled Louis. "You wait," Willa said. And Louis looked at her for a moment, noting the fix of her eyes, the tension around her jaw, and the little vein pulsing at her temple. "I'm out of control," she thought. "If she asked me to throw myself under a jumbo's wheels, I'd say front or back." The engines whirred ferociously, and the plane began to move forward. At her side, Willa's hand found Louis's, and they stood frozen to the spot. At first, it seemed incredibly slow, as if it were just rolling towards them. And Louis could make out people in the flight deck, dimly lit. Then suddenly, the lights at the end of each wing flashed violently, wider and wider, and Louis could see for the first time the body of the plane, its bulk bearing down on them, rushing at them, huge wings outstretched. The sound was overwhelming, shrieking, blaring. Louis wanted to cover her ears, but she didn't want to let go of Willa's hand. She dug her nails as the plane ate up the runway, murderous. And just before her legs began to dissolve, the white lights at the front lifted, and a blast of hot air and thunderous noise burst out from under the aircraft. It screeched above them, its white body burning through the air and the surrounding blackness wobbling in the heat. The smell of burning rubber and exhaust filled Louis's nostrils and mouth, which was open and screaming now, screaming for all she was worth. She was jumping too, jumping down, up, around, and then her arms were around Willa, squeezing her, still yelling and whooping, and Willa was yelling back, and they leapt about in a circle for a bit before Louis realized she actually had her arms around Willa, embracing her, and she decided not to let go. To let go would mean to wait until she had this good an excuse again, and she didn't know when that might be. Louis couldn't bear it anymore. To hell with it, she thought. To hell with it. They stopped jumping. They stopped yelling. And Louis gripped onto Willa, hugged tighter even, and buried her head in her shoulder. Her heart was still thumping, and she could feel Willa's too, like a bird's belting against her ribcage. And then Willa's arms moved, and Louis caught her breath in fear, terrified she'd pull away. She didn't. Her hand cupped Louis's head, ran down the back of her hair, her neck, and lay cool and gentle under her collar. Her other arm moved lightly up her back and rested there. What a difference, the quality of the touch, the subtle shift in placement that turned a hug into a hold. Louis wanted to cry, to weep with relief. She relaxed her wrestling grip and leaned into Willa, nuzzled her heavy hair, felt the soft skin under her ear, breathed in her smell. When Willa turned and kissed her, Louis thought in her head, "This is my first kiss." Well, it wasn't. Of course, she'd kissed a number of guys and more, but she'd never ever felt as if she were falling off a cliff. She'd never before felt as if her body were being turned to water from the inside out, or as if they were both whirling through space into an airless black vortex. Louis felt all these things, and above all, a disbelief, a wild, terrifying disbelief that this should be happening. No, not that she was in love with a girl, for it seemed suddenly absolutely natural that she should be in love with this girl, but that, God only knew how, this girl should love her back. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. Amazing. A beautiful, sustained metaphor. I feel myself flying. Next up, I'd like to welcome Matt Ward. Matt is a graduate of the Creative Writing Program at Manukau Institute of Technology. As part of his concern about the alarming figures around queer youth suicide, he has written about the often one-dimensional representation of queer characters in young adult fiction and of the straightening of protagonists and narratives that occur in mainstream fiction, something we're all aware of. I was personally excited to read some of Matt's work, as this is an area I lecture in here at AUT. It's wonderful to see a young, emerging writer grappling with these issues. I sense a change coming. Matt?
Unfortunately, I've just been set up for a lot of your disappointment. Today, I won't be boring you with some of my essays. Instead, I'll just start. I will speak about the biggest threat facing our community, a disease that tears through communities and ruins gay lives all over the world. I am, of course, talking about heterosexuals. I have a great many problems with the majority, but perhaps the most alarming is this. When a straight person finds out you're gay, they will immediately ask you the precise second you knew you were gay. As if you went to bed one night watching the NRL and eating barbecue ribs, only to wake up in the morning wanting the entire rugby team to piss in your mouth. For three reasons, I will never be a runway gay. One, I don't have thousands of dollars to spend on a mesh vest that will eventually cheese grate my nipples off. Two, the only reason I would spend longer than 10 minutes in a clothing store is if I'd looked at a price tag and died. Death is literally the only way to keep me shopping. And third, I just don't have the cheekbones for that kind of lifestyle. I'll become a model when sweatpants, man boobs, and $27 haircuts become high fashion. So I don't want a straight bashful afternoon, although it is my favourite pastime, but I was recently having a conversation and somebody said, why don't straight people have a parade? So I got down to her intellectual level and said, well, sweetie, when gay people burn straight people alive and deny them their rights for hundreds of years, then you can have a parade. In hindsight, probably not the best way to teach a four-year-old about gay rights. But there we are. Straight people seem convinced that gay people have an insane amount of sex. And the truth, if only for me, is far less sweaty and grand. I realised quite early on in life that my standards were disproportionately higher than my attractiveness. Which is hard enough to deal with, but further insult is added when Stephen Joyce manages to get more cocks in his face than I do. And another annoying thing is the idea that all gay people know each other. A straight will ask, oh my God, do you know Augustine? And no, I would never associate myself with somebody who had a name like that. And she says, well, you guys should totally hook up. He's gay too. As if the only prerequisite I might need to sleep with a man is that he likes my gender. But sweet Augustine does bring to the forefront another problem in our community, and that is the vast imbalance of bottoms to tops. strap yourselves into your chastity belts. There's nothing sadder in my mediocre life than when I see a guy with a huge muscular body and a scruffy jawline and piercing eyes, and the further I scroll down his profile, the more we fall in love, until I finally reach his sexual preferences box and it just says the one word that ruins me: bottom. Nothing is more tragic than a bottom stuck in a top's body. And I have a friend who said, well, couldn't you just make it work? And as I have to tell my dear sweet Annalise on a regular basis, two bottoms simply don't make a top. Finally, the stereotype that all gays are hyper-emotional beings, which may be true for some, but definitely not for me. I have only cried twice in my life. Once out of happiness when my father told me my great nan was dead, and secondly out of sadness when he told me he was just joking. To add some context, she once fed me dog treats. So here's to you, Bertha, you old bitch. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to television in the 2020s. Next up, I would like to invite Heather McPherson to the podium, please. Heather's poetry has been represented in many anthologies, including the Penguin Anthology of New Zealand Verse. In 1976, Heather co-founded Spiral as a journal of women's art and literature. Spiral later developed into a publishing house and published, amongst other things, Kerry Holmes' Booker Prize-winning The Bone People. She is also a visual artist and curator, one of the strongest voices for women in the arts in Aotearoa, New Zealand. But in respect of the theme of this session, it is a quote of hers that stands out to me. Speaking of poems she published in the 1970s, she said, and I quote, "I was then obscuring my identity by using initials, having been advised I stood a better chance of being published if I wasn't known as a woman, let alone a lesbian."
Hi, everybody, and welcome. I practiced too hard during the week. I'm losing my voice. So if you can't hear me, just put your hands up and wave or something. I thought that this was a kind of chronology that needed to be addressed when I was trying to choose poems to read. But all the issues that I was going to bring, I've also addressed. So I might as well, I think, turn the chronology around the other way, because I'm going to run out of time, I think. So the first one is Stuck at the Lights, and the van ahead flashes phantom bill stickers. We never sleep. Good grief. 40 years ago, we snuck out, leaving the babysitters in charge, and did paste-ups with our women's gallery mates, having hung the show and sat spellbound through Friday poems and rounded up kids after women's dances. And look, these days you can buy somebody else's energy for outreach. It's like government selling our markets as the free trade bottom of the Pacific. And I picture us lugging wallpaper glue and posters hot off print collective desks, and spirals out of her story and old bags press, and socialist lesbian typesetters, and lovers and friends' living rooms. But hey, we split our cages and rattled others. And yes, it needs doing again, again, again. Ask any intimidated girls, gays, wives, others, the young struggling and aged thickets. Lights green, feet rev, we lurch in the phantom bill stickers' wake. Our mobility is fugitive. So no, we don't overtake. Just call. Left, left, right, right. No, left, right. Oh, wait. Okay, one of the things that we were addressing as part of the general misogyny around the place was who controls what is published or taught, or is able to be talked about. I was reading Ali Smith, and she had a photograph, four women asleep. And I wrote this portrait, four artists with cups. Four artists sit close together. Two hold flowery cups and saucers. All their eyes are shut. Is it a gender statement? And they embody a tableau, the unawakened woman. Are they heterosexual, gay, lesbian, gender queer, in between? Who decreed their unpresence and cast them as absentees? In my grandparents' overgrown backyard, I played at being the prince who hacked through blackberry and bramble and kissed the princess awake, and we rode her white horse back to the palace majesties and married and lived happily, if not ever after, at least now, legally. Did a husband or husbands take this shot? So artists who were women couldn't be artists again, and nobody knew they'd been, their art unseen. Well, Leonora kept painting serenely surreal dreams. Lee Miller's wartime photos winged to Auckland Museum. Her son unpacked them from the attic after she died. Rinse the poison cups. Feed the bloody spindle to the fire. Old myths expire. And you, will you dance, awake, and weave new myths? You and three similar friends, refiguring the arts. And finally, because I've only got breath for that, this book that I wrote in the 90s, 1991 it was published, and I looked through it and I thought, goodness, oh, I was so angry then. Oh, and then I got to the end and I thought, oh, well, yes, we were angry. We were addressing misogyny, which is a lot about what's in here, including the unfortunate experiment. And then I ended up, my lover moves. My lover moves long thighs and capable hands. My lover hammers nails and shovels dirt. My lover cradles breasts and handles horses. My lover strokes my ligaments into water. My lover dances, sings, and designs a city. My lover turning heads and filaments and strings. My lover drives through continents and beliefs and sweeping outer spaces where pasts and futures mix. We together in them to undo presents, gifts, and go-betweens. Climb cliffs and mediations. Make births and deaths and illuminations. My lover, when she fights, drowns ghosts and laughs and opens life.
Thank you, Heather. What a beautiful image. As Heather mentioned, we're pushing time, so I'll leap further forwards. Next up, Michelle Drury. Michelle is a Bachelor of Creative Arts graduate from MIT's Creative Writing Program. She's co-founder of the New Zealand National Poetry Slam and current MC at New Zealand's longest-running weekly poetry event, Poetry Live, which has been running for 35 years. Was it 36 years as of 2016. Michelle is also a passionate activist for mental health awareness.
Hi, obviously I wasn't the MC at Poetry Live for the last 35 years, as I'm only coming up 40. But I'm very, very honoured to be a part of a long line of MCs. Just before I start, I don't have a lot in terms of reading about my sexuality because I'm very happy and comfortable and don't feel threatened, which is quite refreshing, I would imagine. But also I do want to say that, yes, I am married to a man right now, and yes, I have had heterosexual sex to have three children. That does not make me heterosexual. Genderless. Imagine when you woke up this morning, you were greeted to a world with no visible gender. Your friends, family, exes, and hopeful lovers, all genderless, but at the same time, exactly as you remember them. With all their beautiful flaws and scarred charms, still putting your desire for human connection on that factory line of life knowledge and experience. But today, each new encounter begins to expose the absence of intentions, and you realize how difficult it's going to be to determine where your intensity of attraction expressions can and should be capped. You see, gender and its easy identity is the upstaging actor on the stage of most days, but today these guidelines haven't been drafted and sexual preferences and their displays don't even exist. It's like a toddler daycare with no caring parentals. As liberating as it seems, the level of your maturity and common sense is too underdeveloped to slow the sway of love's consecutive pendulum. Because the Jesse whom you've just met may feel like hypnotism at first glance compared to lifelong friend Terry, whom you've never really wanted to touch. And then there's Danny, whom you want to crawl inside of to hibernate, but just for 2 winters, unaware it could turn Joe into the one that got away. But this smooth innocence wrinkles the day as Danny is a flame you need to be physically close to, while Joe slips in and out to remind you how much difference a single day and a single friend can make. And Terry's never looked more at home in this world of casual hands and insistent fingers, while you haven't a clue as to how to obtain a clue on whether a Jesse and you could have ever been more than just a passionate possibility. You see, today has only altered to you. The rest have resided here the whole time, and they cannot understand your shallow ignorance and flippant display of your supposed variety in this genderless society. And as the day sits at sunset, your loved ones feel played, unappreciated, used, disrespected by someone who is obviously incapable of deep-seated love with all those complexities dressing this genderless society. Your naked sexuality is seen as dishonesty. When this day finally darkens, its exhaustion and futility are your empathizing company as you fall asleep and hope to dream away the hours in your old world, a world you felt a spectator in sexuality's gallery. And that's about as close as I can get you to the difficulty in understanding my world, a world of blurred sexuality. And the last one I was going to read for you very quickly is a love poem I wrote for a girl called Teacups. Familiar faces fill already busy spaces, and I can't keep my mind off you. Not even in the room, and still your respirating smile slides down the side of my shy guide as I lie to myself, say I can fly through your eyes before you blink. Where I can liquidly sink into your mild hideaway and never have to go. Where I can somehow set my flow to a slower show of the grown moments between us and lean us against the screaming in my head for something more. More of you and more of my boredom. Turn chores into scores of nervous courtship and the quiver of a touch more than friendship. Send skin to thin to vulnerable shivers so I can't keep my mind off you. Not even the looming thunder of inspiration can make blunder a distraction from the stumbler your wonder is tumbling out of me. Out of meaning to shrink to predictable hints so you can sink closer to me. With your soothing lips like cloud pillow tips, what a trip they must be to kiss in some hissful sip of lid-closed bliss where wind pushes my hands to your hips and my mind won't want to sift and drift from you to sift through this lightning flame feeling that my tamed heart is wild once more, like desire's lamed part can strive once more, for my fascination adolescently explores what is already so easy to see. You've stormed more than a teacup in me.
Thank you, Michelle. Awesome and succinct. Next up, Julie Hedain. I'd love you to come up, please. Julie needs no introduction. Oh, all right. No, but I'm going to give her one anyway. She is a Master of Creative Writing graduate from the University of Auckland. She's been published in Landfall magazine and was the winner of the Catherine Mansfield Literary Award for her short story, Misjudged. Her novel, The Open Accounts of an Honesty Box, was published in 2011 and has been produced for national radio. She was also one of the judges for the Wallace Arts Prize Best Short Story. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you. I'll stand here, and if you can't hear me, please speak up. This is 1989, a few months before the great sesquicentenary. If you remember, that was 150 years celebration of the Treaty of Waitangi. And guess what? The anti-racism groups are mobilising. She can read the night. She sprawls at the far end of the bus shelter, legs apart, and waits. For what? The clouds to clear, the moon to rise over the ridge, the clock to strike midnight? A particular shade of dark?
We should have done the hip ages ago. Instead, we're still hanging around Richmond Road, her hoodie up, my beanie down, both of us feeling the cold. But I'm not complaining. I know she needs me. She needs someone nimble and handy with a spray can. And I'm glad because not many Māori will work with Pākehā, let alone trust us to staunch up when it comes to radical action. Perhaps she hears me sighing because her head turns, one eyebrow raised and grinning, like she knows what I'm thinking, like she can read me as well as the night. Oh, it's all clear. What say we do it now, eh? It comes out funny, a vibration in my jaw that makes my teeth judder like when I bike over the Waimea Street Bridge. I bury a yawn in the neck of my sweatshirt, thinking I'll be lucky to grab 5 hours sleep. Even if things do go according to plan, it's fine for Kat. She can sleep till 10 and still make her Monday morning Tereo tutorial. But then Kat would crawl over broken glass to attend her uni lectures. Bloody sad that you'd have to go to university to discover your language and your culture, to get a grasp on racism, to find other Māori students who would offer your first real taste of whānau. But what do I know? None of my business. All I know is she needs a buddy to do the hits with, someone on hand and handy with graffiti, someone who knows their treaty responsibilities and doesn't argue. I jiggle my backpack. Well, okay, what about now? I hear the squeak in my voice. No wonder she throws me a look, blows on the end of her cigarette, then takes another puff. Oh, I'm not nervous. I'm just amped up and ready. Fuck's sake, who's going to bother two women spray painting the liquor shop wall? It's the police we need to watch for. Cops running the lights with sirens blazing, cops sneaking around in unmarked Holdens. Now I've had a thought. Kat sits up and snaps her fingers at me. That liquor shop, it's a white wall, right? White is everything that's good, pure and clean, virginal and angelic. That's what Pākehā think, eh? Then she throws me that look, goofy grin on her face like I'm dumb or something. Well, Kat may be studying politics and the whole Māori studies thing, and she may call herself an academic, but I'd call her 5'10" of hot, smoking anger. Which is why I almost feel sorry for her. She's the right stuff to become a leader like the other Māori in the movement, like Denny, like Uncle and Nanny Pearl. Only Kat doesn't have the gene or whatever it is for fear. And sooner or later, all that uppity and all that confidence and all that risk-taking is going to end us in a whole lot of trouble. What can I do? When she moved into the flat with her wilting philodendron, she was just another dyke looking for a cat-friendly vegetarian house close to uni. Now, Jasmine and me had no idea what could happen to a person enrolled in Māori studies. In 18 months, our flatmate became a fully-fledged radical activist, filling the house with books and posters, Tereo labels on everything, and a whole lot of talk about the treaty. Turns out that Kat's mum had been too busy with their dry cleaning business in Whangarei to give Kat much in the way of tikanga and tereo, let alone the ins and outs of the Treaty of Waitangi. She's already told me a bit about herself, that her mum was a hungry businesswoman and her Pākehā stepdad knew every trick in the book for removing stains. There's a satisfied chuckle. Beside me, Kat's been thinking up slogans. She's pleased with herself and tells me what to write on the wall. Next thing, she's chucking her fag in the gutter, leaps up and stamps her high tops on the pavement. No point sitting around freezing our asses. Come on, Charlie, get going, eh? Stands there with her hands on her hips like she's waiting, like I'm the one holding things up. The wall of the liquor shop is under eaves and dry enough to take a hit. I give my can a hard shake, tensing at the sound as the ball bearing does its razzmatazz inside the can at 1,000 decibels. Can't be helped. You don't shake, you get a clogged nozzle. And if you rush, You'll throw the letters up nice and big at the start, only to have them bunch at the end, which leaves the whole slogan looking like some sad fuck doodle on a pencil case. So it's critical, that pause, to have the picture clear in your mind before you hit the nozzle. No point telling Cat to pause. She'll attack the wall with paint, never mind that Tino Ranga Tira Tanga has 18 letters. Each one needing space to breathe. Next day, Cat's message will be sitting there, letters rammed up where she's run out of wall and the whole thing looking like a graffiti train wreck. Minutes go by, nothing but the night closing around us. Go for it, she says. Then something in Māori. While I get to work, she stands behind me, once again practicing her Māori on someone who doesn't know, as she likes to say, a hipi from a hori. Long, even strokes, red venom hissing on to white. I've had plenty of spelling mistakes and smear-ups in the past, but this one's a perler. Nice. White. Wall.
Thank you, Julie. Amazing. I'm heading straight home to put out some spray cans. I'm saying. And finally, I would like to welcome Madeline Reed. Madeline graduated from Auckland University's Creative Writing School and has been accepted into a Masters of Creative Writing program at the prestigious Institute of Modern Letters as part of the Page Stream. Congratulations. She's planning a novel this year.
So this is an excerpt from a novel that I'm writing called Dear November. And at this point in the story, Ava, the main character, is having some trouble at work with her boss, who's quite a conservative figure, and with a young male guest who won't stop hitting on her, even though she has a girlfriend. Pardon my French for the first part. What a complete fucking cow, Ava said. She threw the covers off the bed and bundled them into a white mound on the carpet. And him, she snarled. He's got another thing coming if he thinks he can just play me like a fucking pawn like that. Prick. You're beautiful when you're angry. Greta, please. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Ava sighed and threw herself down into the laundry heap. She let the shirts and dresses cascade over her stomach like a tap and flicked her hair back, casting a brazen look at her girlfriend. It's all right, said Greta, descending too. She cupped Ava's head in her arms and began to rock her gently. It will be all right soon. Things will settle down, I promise. How do you know that, said Ava. How do you actually know that, though? She threw her hands up in the air, making a scissor motion. If I'm supposed to work here for the next 8 months or so, how am I meant to deal with this? Tell me, Greta, how? Time will tell, she said. I hope so. She curled around so that her torso was flanked between Greta's hips, her elbows on her knees and her head in her lap. She linked hands with her, enjoying the smooth knoll of her hair being played with, and the other woman's breath fluttering against her neck. She kissed her, slowly at first and then harder. They kissed until their mouths were cupped and the sweat was beading and their hands were tight around each other's waists, tugging for something unfound and uniquely ungraspable. For all of the love and all of the passion administered in those silent meetings in the hallways, shoulders colliding, feet shuffling and tapped under the scuffing lunchroom tables. They both felt giddy and drunk, like they were still at high school together, meeting secretly in the music block practice rooms and having sex with the lights off, the door fastened, and the bass drum rolling and rattling away in a dull, harmonious thud. Wait, wait, stop, said Greta, pulling away. What is it? Ava sprawled herself out on the bed, reaching desperately for the straps on her puffin blouse. They were thick and difficult to undo. Her hands were trembling. I've got this stupid class, said Greta suddenly. I've got this class I have to teach now. She motioned to the clock. I only just noticed the time. Ava glanced over. It was 7:15. Outside, the night air blinkered through the porteries in waves of compressed notes. A child falling off their skis. A tui in one of the fir trees, cooing like New Zealand's only owl. Damn it, she thought. God damn it, Greta. Well, I guess I'm going to the markets then. She pulled her sweater on, hugging it around her angrily. I hope you have a good class. Ava, wait, don't worry about it, she said, smiling. She kissed her on the powdered cheek and smiled again. I'll be fine out on my own. Queenstown hosted a fortnightly night market, selling stalls of white fuchsia and oiled spring rolls and candles that smelt like thyme and wick. There were strands of lights, roped in loops across the telephone poles, shining luminously from flowered paper boats and taffy cradles. Everywhere was roaring. Everyone was keen. Large groups of fetting teenagers gathered by the central bridge, bum-puffing Marlboro lights like they were the coolest things out after Winona Ryder in the 90s. Ava walked past them and killed a laugh. She bet they hadn't seen Reality Bites. Down by the throated waterfront she walked, feeling sad and lonely. She leant on the port side rail, watching the glowing water and alchemical moon. It was beautiful and translucent and wild, like something you couldn't clasp properly, like something you couldn't see. She fished out her phone, scrolling through the dials, and read again. One missed call from Mum. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. A clear evocation of now. Finally, I would like to invite Ron Brownson to the podium. As many of you will know, Ron is a senior curator at the Auckland Art Gallery. He's going to present an acknowledgement of David Lyndon Brown.
For just a few moments, a few minutes, I'd like to remember David Lyndon Brown. He would be here today, but he's not because he's dead. He died on the 30th of December last year. I met David in February 1971, and I remember kind acts, and he was very kind to me in 1971. And so what I'd like to do today is just say some things from his writings so that we can just remember him, because David has mentored a lot of people as a writer. He had a wonderful service at the Herne Bay Patank Club. I've never been there before, but as I was going there, I stopped off at Dominion Books, and in the window was Vladimir Nabokov's memoir of his time in Russia, Speak Memory. So in a sense, I suppose, the tone that I'd like to take today, and thank you, Peter, for asking me, is one of Speak Memory. David came to writing later in life, when he was, in that phrase of his parents' generation, middle-aged. He was firstly a visual artist, but a somewhat secret and reclusive one. Although David held a number of exhibitions, he never really promoted the fact that he'd been making paintings. In many ways, his paintings were analogues to his writings. His paintings really served as illustrations of moods and relationships operating like visual poems. And I've always felt David's paintings share the presence of yearning, communicated best by this phrase, "My deep, dark pain is love." David's most confident creative medium was as a short story writer and as a poet. He wrote his 2007 novella, Marked Men, as an extended narrative. And the book's blurb described it as an eerie novel taking, quote, adventure into the realm of crime, sudden disappearances, and the violent fantasies of longing. Here is the novella's first two sentences and its final sentence. Not many people know how or when the Institute of Pain began. Just about everyone knows how it finished. The last sentence is really one of the best sentences David wrote. Come here, I said to the boy, and tell me some lies about yourself. David was a fine-tuned scopophiliac. He was addicted to looking. The cover of his 2009 book of poems, Skin Hunger, has the book's title and his own name projected onto the flesh of a male torso. This is an image that had to be dreamed of before it was made and carefully pre-planned before it was photographed in dark light. David wrote in the dialect of desire, Desire is a dialect he uses for all his writing, and it adds stings to his phrasing. From Neighbourhood Watch: "Your smoke signals lure me to the balcony. Reflected in the glass balustrade, I see your hand, cigarette poised. I see your stomach, I see the nipples of your chest. Your head is cut off." David cherished the writings of Walt Whitman and Constantine Cavafy. Like those poets, he was inspired by yearning, by craving, by wanting, by thirsting. The title poem, Skin Hunger, articulates this need. This poem is written in mucus, it is written in cum, it is written in tears. The poem is about you. This poem is about the span of you, the way you hinge and flex, your sublime architecture. This poem is about the grip of you, your caress, your approaches and withdrawals. This poem is about the alliance, no, the allegiance of skin, the prints you left, the little damages. It is not finished. David Lyndon Brown's books are hard to find. All were printed in small runs by boutique publishers, or some were self-published. Few people and few libraries own complete sets of his publication. That's a sad fact, I think. David began his writing in the 1990s, and his first collection of stories is the 2001 Calling the Fish and Other Stories. And to prepare this, I reread everything David wrote that had been published, and I really recommend, if you haven't read it for a while, Calling the Fish needs to be returned to. It was followed by Mark Men in 2007. Last year, David told me that he was working on a novel that he thought could never be published. I don't know what the future of that manuscript will be. And some of you will know that during the last couple of years, David wrote four really perceptive reviews, and thank you, William Dart, for inviting those to happen, for Art New Zealand. He recounts one story that he learnt from Douglas Wright that could also have been about himself, and I asked Douglas if I could read this, and he's quite happy about it. So this is David recalling Douglas's story. Wright tells me that when he was a little boy growing up in the South Auckland township of Tuakau, he had an overwhelming urge to dance. In suburban New Zealand in the 1960s, this was inconceivable. As Wright's mother Pat says in Haunting Douglas, it just wasn't done. Boys played rugby, end of story. So Wright sublimated this urge into gymnastics, the closest sport there is to dance, and at this, naturally, Douglas excelled. When this excellence was rewarded or praised, Wright's classmates would sidle up murmuring, "Shame, shame, shame." Of course, those boys knew instinctively what little Douglas was up to. They knew that beneath the obfuscation of gymnastics lay something unspeakable, and they felt compelled by tradition and the culture of the land to censure him for A, daring to excel, and B, exemplifying the sissy. I want to read four very brief extracts from four stories in Calling the Fish. The first paragraph of Cracked. "You want to grow some skin. That's what you want to do." Godfrey Sweet sliced a potato in half and inserted a sliver of butter. He waited for the butter to melt and then quartered it. "And some teeth," she continued, "and some guts." Godfrey proceeded to bisect a sausage. Sometimes he wondered why he'd ever bothered to get married. David adored the space between words written and sense taken. And this is a technique well used by Cavafy, who hung meaning on the gap between meaning and suggestibility. That, as you all know, is one of the essences of camp, demarcated by Susan Sontag in David's favourite essay, where Susan writes, "To snare a sensibility in words, especially one that is alive and powerful, one must be tentative and nimble." And here's the opening to Spanish Steps, which is about Kerry Leach, who was David's closest friend at Elam Art School. And Kerry's mother came to New Zealand with my mother, so I knew Kerry well when I was a child. Kerry rattles his bangles. He threads them onto his right wrist when he drives the bodgy car to lend glamour to his hand signals. The car is an ugly shaped Velox painted a raucous Fanta colour, the sort of car that could have flames spurting up its sides, the kind that real men drive with a sneer and an elbow out the window. The bangles add a frisson. For David, that short story was both reportage and evidence. It's a memory of Kerry's provocations, where he laughed off the way gay men were treated in New Zealand in the 1960s. Irony is a vehicle camp perspectives. David's story, The Mortification of Henry James, begins. Henry James was a man of impeccable habits. He was pure of heart and clean of body. Each day he rose at least 2 hours before he was due to start work in order to present a pleasant appearance. After a light breakfast of one of three cereals he ate in strict rotation, he took a full bath and then rinsed himself under the shower because he had heard somewhere that the Japanese, a race he held in high regard for their cleanliness, were horrified at the Western custom of just stepping out of a bath full of one's own filth. He then took a fresh towel, dried himself carefully, and slipping into this powder blue terry cloth kimono, approached the mirror. Henry James took great pleasure in the ritual of shaving, a procedure most men find irksome. He loved the way that the stubble came away beneath the blade, leaving his skin soft and glowing pink. I think every word in that paragraph has been so carefully chosen that we recognize the elegant effeteness tinged with the tonality of committed narcissism. David's writings cherish human foibles as if they were secrets proving we are real. His powers of observation mirror our discomfort, especially when we find it difficult to cope with appearances that signal difference, aloneness, which signal uniqueness. That specialness of individuality that can for some people also be a visual cross which they wear. And the story of hope is a story washed with challenging moments of pain and triumph. It begins, Hope Fuller was not only cursed with that name, she was afflicted with a port wine stain that ran down the side of her nose and bled onto her cheek. This defect had not only marred her looks, it has also disfigured her personality. Hope Fuller easily took umbrage and was quick to point out the shortcomings of others. It was as though her birthmark had given her special privilege to criticize and jeer. She made no attempt to cover up the mark and sometimes seemed to flaunt it by choosing a matching shade of lipstick. It looked as if, in a fit of madness or boredom, she had scribbled in the middle of her great big face. And then the story concludes, the only sound to be heard in the Isles of Packensave was the Muzak version of The Way We Were. The customers shuffled and stared. The handprint stinging Hopefuller's cheeks merged with her birthmark so that it looked as if she was wearing a purple veil. In a kind of trance, she retrieved the cash register, plugged it in, sat down to the checkout stool and began automatically passing the backlog of groceries over the scanner. And gradually, soothed by the rhythm of her vocation, the look of her face metamorphosized from one of fury to one of ineffable victory. So I reckon David Lyndon Brown had much more writing within him. When speaking of the novel he was writing, he described how he would use it raw and it would use raw and honest language. I saw in David's eyes that look I long remembered, the look of curiosity, the look of defiance, and the look of self-worth. There are other parts of David's life which I have not mentioned this afternoon. Many of you will be aware of his creative mentoring of others. We remember you, David.
Thank you so much, Ron. That was wonderful. We really have run out of time. I would like to remind you all that our writers will be sitting out at the signing table. I think they all have books out there. They're more than welcome to purchase or just come and chat with them, ask them questions. Thank you very, very much for attending. Much appreciated.